I first want to thank you for having me and let you know that it's a pleasure for me to be here to talk about the disease of alcoholism. What Sue did not include in that wonderful introduction is that I am a recovering alcoholic and recovering codependent, and I will be including bits and pieces about myself as it pertains to this lecture, which is entitled The Disease of Alcoholism, A Brief Overview of the Disease of Chemical Dependence. And I have to get used to this projector, so please bear with me. What I do want to ask of you is please bear in mind, although I am going to be talking namely about the alcoholic, I need for you please to understand I'm talking about the polysubstance dependent individual as well. Today, it's very rare that we have anyone come into a treatment setting or walking in the doors of AA or NA or CA that is exclusively an alcohol-dependent individual. Today, we're seeing people that are getting into polysubstance use, and I'll talk more about that as we get on in the lecture. If there is one thing that you take with you from this lecture, I would certainly hope that it is the fact that it's not a matter of being weak-willed or immoral or evil or sinful or a bad person. It's simply a matter of having a sex-linked recessive biogenetic disorder. In plain English, it means that you have to be born with the disease of alcoholism in order to be an alcoholic. No one, to the best of my recollection, ever says to their parents, gee, Mommy and Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be the world's best alcoholic possible. It just doesn't work out that way. Folks generally say, you know, I want to be a real good doctor. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be an Indian chief. But never do they say, I want to be an alcoholic. Okay? The more the newer word, apart from sex-linked recessive biogenetic disorder, is pharmacogenetic disorder. Characteristic features of this disease are that it is a chronic illness, it is progressive, it is relapsing, and it is fatal. Chronic, in essence, means that there is no cure. At best, you can maintain the disease in remission through a 12-step program of recovery practiced on a one-day-at-a-time basis. Maintaining any and total abstinence from any and all mood-altering chemicals, of which alcohol is a mood-altering chemical, on a one-day-at-a-time basis. It is a progressive illness in the sense that it does get worse. Someone coming into recovery, walking in through the doors of AA or walking into a treatment center that begins to work a program of recovery, goes back out and starts using, reports consistently that, gee, you know what, it really got worse out there. It really got bad for me, okay? Never do you hear someone come back and say, you know, it really got better. I improved at my alcohol use. I improved at my drug use. You know, I'm really honing these skills. It doesn't work that way. This is a relapsing illness. And what I do want to point out, I really cringe when I hear people say slip, because slip makes light of a serious of an activation of a fatal illness. Okay, I need to emphasize that folks that are in recovery, Al-Anon as well as AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, need to grab hold of the seriousness of the nature of an illness that they have and talk about, I had a relapse last night. Not, hey, you know, I was sitting down with the fellas looking at this football game and I took a sip off of Joe's beer. Okay, I had a little slip last night. Or going down to a rock concert, and you know what, I don't smoke pot, but there was this guy smoking this funny cigarette, and I was feeling pretty good, and I took a little puff off of this magic cigarette, so I had a slip last night. It doesn't work that way. You never hear about, for example, the patient with tuberculosis is taking medication for their tuberculosis, start coughing up blood, and said, you know, last night I had a little slip, I started coughing up blood. Those people really understand that it's an activation of what ultimately is a fatal disease, okay? If it goes untreated, unaddressed. I Okay, I meant to make these little people before the lecture, but I'll try to do that now. Are they all on here? Yes, practically. Okay, these here are seven individuals, a cross-section of people in the United States. As you'll notice, these two up here are users. These folks are your social alcohol users, your social beer drinkers, your social party goers. Everyone gets handed a glass of alcohol when they walk into a party. These two folks up here are the ones that nurse the drink all night long. They put more ice in it. They put more ginger ale in it. And basically what they wind up doing is they enjoy the party, okay? And they go home when the party's over and continue on with the rest of their lives. To expand on this a little bit more, these are the folks, for example, that run into a 5-milligram Valium. Okay, anyone in this room ever hear of the drug Valium? Okay. Run across a 5-milligram Valium, split it in half and share it, and are perfectly happy in doing so. Okay. These folks also are the ones that walk up to some cocaine laid out on a coffee table at a party, snort half a line of cocaine and get a little thrill out of it and walk away from the table where the cocaine is laid out. And in essence, this is normal chemical use. Understand, I am not at all condoning the use of chemicals. I'm not saying it's okay to take somebody else's Valium, or it's okay to smoke pot, or it's okay to use the cocaine. What I'm saying is, in the human animal, if anything approximates normal chemical use, it's going to be these two individuals up here. These five, okay, traditionally called abusers, and I want to make a point here. Okay, alcohol abuse, for anyone that works in addictive disease medicine or works in the field of chemical dependence, is understood to be when a alcoholic takes a bottle of alcohol, puts it down on the floor, and kicks it around. Okay, that is alcohol abuse. What I want you to understand... What I want you to understand is that this is alcohol misuse. These five individuals here misuse chemical substances. And the reason that we're changing this word through the American Medical Society on alcoholism and other drug dependencies is abuse is a terribly judgmental word, okay? And we want folks to get away from the guilt trips and beating themselves and basically feel good about the fact that they're in recovery and remaining sober on a one day at a time framed through a 12-step program of recovery. So start talking about this as chemical or alcohol misuse, if you would. Anyway, these five individuals are the ones that drink at the boss if they get hired, or drink at the boss if they get fired, or they got a wedding to go to and they get drunk, or they got a wake to go to and they get drunk, or it's raining outside and they get drunk, or they perceive a flat on their car and they get drunk. There's always a reason for these folks to go ahead and party down, celebrate, or use some type of chemical. The difference here is with these misusers is that the wife says to the husband, gee, you know, that's the last time I'm ever going to go out with you drinking that amount of alcohol and behaving in that fashion. Or the husband says to the wife, you know, that's the last time I'm ever going to put up with you using that cocaine like that. You really get bizarre. Or in essence, the boss says, Joe, the next time you come in here with alcohol in your breath from the past night, I'm going to fire you. Or these folks suffer a DUI, or they get arrested for possession of narcotics, or they'll go ahead and get arrested for concealed weapons, okay? In essence, what happens is these individuals are able to say, hey, you know, things are starting to go wrong in my life, and I want no more a part of this than I was having. So they go ahead and they stop their alcohol or other chemical use. And in essence, they can carry on their life without a formal program of recovery. Some of these folks can even cut back on their use of chemicals, and they're able to do that successfully. All except one, and I need to get on this side of the light. This person here, this individual, one out of these five, does what we call an addictive disease medicine, crosses over the wall of alcoholism, crosses over the wall, and no longer does this person misuse alcohol or other chemicals. This person now uses in order to stay alive. It's no longer a misuse of chemicals. And I'm going to really get into that as this lecture goes on. Okay, characteristic features of this disease are that it is an emotional, social, spiritual, physical, professional illness. It also very much affects the family. It affects every single arena of the alcoholic's life. Briefly, let me mention three discrete specialties that in the past have failed in their efforts to help the alcoholic or chemically dependent individual. The first of these being a traditional psychiatry. In essence, what these folks do is, with the best of intentions, wanting to help a truly sick individual, offer one-on-one counseling, offer more medications, try to find out why an individual uses alcohol or other chemicals. If you go ahead and you concentrate on why an alcoholic or chemically dependent individual uses chemicals, your search is going to be eternal. Okay, this is the primary illness. The use of the chemicals is not secondary to some major personality or psychiatric disorder. This is a primary illness. The second one of the specialties that has failed in the past is the clergy. And I say this with a lot of love because these folks really do see folks suffering and want to offer some help. But when you come at someone, a sick individual, and try to get them to change their lifestyle as well as chemical use by talking about them along judgmental terms, or even throwing words out such as willpower, okay, you're not going to reach an individual that has a chronic, progressive, relapsing, fatal illness. The third specialty is, of course, law enforcement. And what generally happens with alcoholics or chemically dependent individuals is they get thrown in jail. And what these folks do is they use while they're in jail, or they use the minute they get out, or both. So this fails miserably. In essence, because the way to tackle this disease, you have to reach every single arena in the alcoholic's life, the emotional, social, spiritual, physical, professional, family aspects, using the multidisciplinary treatment approach as is done in several treatment centers that treat this disease successfully, or of course the traditional way, which is through the 12-step programs. And when I mention treatment, of course I'm talking about the 12-step program supplementing a treatment of this disease. Okay. Signs and symptoms of this illness. This list I'm going to give credit to Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism. It describes a beautiful list of signs and symptoms in the book. What I do want to point out is that traditionally medicine signs and symptoms are, of course, 180 degrees opposite what these signs and symptoms are. In medicine, for example, a sign is anything that as a doctor I can put a stethoscope on and listen to, or feel with my hand, or see a rash, or perceive a smell coming from a patient. It's something objective. And a symptom is something I have to take the patient's word for. Hey, doc, my head hurts, my back hurts, my vision's blurry. Okay? Signs and symptoms for this disease of alcoholism are job loss, financial problems, separations, being disowned, if you would, infidelity. And when I talk about infidelity, I'm not using that in the judgmental sense. I'm not at all alluding to the fact that there has to be a recognized marriage. I'm just talking about one individual stepping outside of the bounds of a recognized relationship, where one significant other steps out on the other. In imprisonment, illness. And here the list is endless when it comes to physical as well as mental illness, and I'm not even going to get into that. We could take up another lecture slot for the illnesses caused by this disease. Overdose, suicide gestures, attempts, and completed suicide, okay, are symptomatic of the disease of alcoholism. What I do want to point out is in dealing with this population on a daily basis, as well as with the psychiatric population at GMHI in Atlanta, we've come to know that suicide in the psychiatric population is behavior. Suicide in the alcoholic or addicted population is a drug, is a chemical. Okay, this is the ultimate relapse. This is something that every alcoholic or chemically dependent individual is subject to, and this is why we really encourage folks to continue to work their program, their lives, as though their lives depend on it, because in essence it really does. The number one sign of the disease of alcoholism is the compulsivity. Okay, gee, it's 10:30 Saturday night. I have to run out to 7-Eleven and get my beer, because if I don't get my beer, I'm not going to be able to drink tomorrow. And it's Sunday and the football games are on, okay? So the compulsivity of getting the alcohol or other chemicals, as well as the compulsivity of use. After someone is basically inches away from passing out, the drinking continues. Okay, that is a characteristic sign of this disease. The number one symptom being denial. And the characteristic feature of denial is that the patient doesn't know that he or she is in denial. Folks really believe what it is that they're saying is to be the absolute truth. Folks really believe what they're saying is the truth. They don't mean to lie. They are not lying. They really believe what they're telling you. This is a good time for me to point out that personally I had every single one of these signs and symptoms of this disease, and this is when I was captured, would be the word that my family would use. I had lost my job, I had lost my medical license, I'd lost my DEA number, I was splashed in the newspapers in that area. I was facing 50 years because my behavior was a bit less than what folks expected a doctor's behavior to be. I, of course, almost lost my family. My family did survive through that and stick with me. I had lost 60 pounds by the time I showed up in my first treatment center. And of course, I didn't have the disease of alcoholism or the disease of chemical dependence. In essence, people did not understand me. People were out to get me. You see, you'd drink alcohol and use Paragoric and Placidil and Percodan and cocaine and Ritalin and dextromethorphan and just about anything else that you could get your hands on if you had my problems. Okay? The judge and the police didn't really seem to understand that that I could write prescription for Quaalude for my dogs, you see, because they were my dogs. No one really wanted to understand these things. No one seemed to understand that the black bag, the little medical bag, was so I could survive en route from hospital to hospital, okay, with the little flasks of all sorts of little goodies in there. In essence, I'm real happy to report that I have all of these things back, license, job, family, etc., etc. Most importantly of all, most important of all, is I have me today, and that's something that I never, ever even knew existed. I thought in the past, if you talked about having yourself, it was kind of corny and kind of boring. Okay, but today I got me. Apart from that, I got a way of relating to life through a wonderful set of steps, a 12-step program of recovery approach to staying alive on a daily basis, one day at a time. And even more important than that, I have a way of relating to a power greater than myself that is just out of this world. It's wonderful. This thing loves me, cares for me, is there for me. So, in essence, life is good today, but I had to learn this the hard way, as well as folks that do enter recovery. Folks generally don't walk into recovery saying, gee, you know, the birds are singing, the sun's shining, the trees are green, I'm going to walk into a treatment center, I'm going to walk into AA today because I'm bored. You know, it doesn't work that way. Generally, there's something going on, and this is a good time to point out, even with one of these things going on in the alcoholic's life, this is where the family is affected. This is where the disease of the family comes in. This is where the protecting that individual, you know, making sure no one finds out about Joe last night, what he did. This is where the family sacrifices their morals, their values, keeping that individual from consequences. This is where Al-Anon families experience life in the raw, while the chemically dependent individual is basically blown away with alcohol or other chemical substances. And I need for people to really recognize that and give yourselves credit. But not only give yourselves credit, do something with that. All the overwhelming anger and pain that's just seething. Okay? This is a wonderful step, a wonderful program to do something with that, but it's got to be done. It needs to be recognized and it needs to be worked on. And nothing is better for this than Al-Anon. Okay? And this is what I just mentioned, the disease of the family, the disease of codependence, co-alcoholism, para-alcoholism, adult children of alcoholics or adult children of addicts, basically can be lumped in a book called the DSM-3R, which is a book psychiatry uses to classify mental illness under post-traumatic stress disorder. And I do want to point out that this is the same category under which individuals that have gone to Vietnam and suffered through the Vietnam experience, the Vietnam vet syndrome, okay, this is where folks get classified as well. So the traumas of war together with the traumas of living with an addicted individual at home pretty much equate on a certain level, and I need to point that out. And again, I can't stress enough the importance of Al-Anon, okay, family support groups, but I also want to really put in a plug for professional counseling and help. This is a time when support groups other than the 12-step program are very necessary. Okay, the 12-step programs are wonderful for the fellowship and learning how to work those steps together, putting into action what one can gain through the counseling and the group therapy. The insight gained in those settings can be put to work through the 12-step programs. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and get a little technical on y'all now and begin talking about substances called neurotransmitters. And I do want to point out at this time that before, it used to be thought of that the brain ran on electrical impulse. This, of course, is found to be totally untrue. The brain runs on chemicals called neurotransmitters. All of these chemicals are manufactured up at the level of the brain. Okay? They're all manufactured in the central nervous system, which is a fancy way of saying the brain and the spinal cord. This here is a picture of a brain that, of course, has been taken out of the skull on autopsy. This part, well, I'll get into describing that shortly. This here is if one were able to take a sharp enough knife and slice down this way on a dead body and look at what at the result from the side, this is what you look at. This area up here is called cerebral cortex. Okay, in essence, this area is known also as new brain because in evolutionary terms, it is relatively new. Let me write this for those of you taking notes. Cerebral cortex. Oh, that's not too visible. Okay. this area right here. I was also going to point out that this handwriting isn't too bad for a doctor now. You have to admit that. Okay. This area back here, this, by the way, this new brain, this cerebral cortex, is responsible for intellect and judgment for our purposes. Let's say intellect and judgment. This area of the brain down here, known as the cerebellum, for our purposes, let's say, is responsible for coordination. Okay? This part of the brain that goes down through the spinal canal is the spinal cord, and what it does is relay from the brain out to the rest of the body, as well as pick up from the body and bring up to the brain. The area that concerns us is this area here, known as the limbic system, or old brain. Old brain in evolutionary terms, because it is the oldest. It's been around the longest, okay? This is the instinct center, the survival center. This is the reason why the organism is alive. This is what's kept everyone in this room, as well as anyone who has the disease of chemical dependence, alive through that experience. Okay, I now want to concentrate on neurotransmitters that are manufactured up within the limbic system, this area of the brain here. Okay? The first one of these, and this happens in everyone, this happens in non-addicts, non-alcoholics, as well as addicts and alcoholics. Okay? This happens in earth people as well as alcoholics. The first one of the substances I want to talk about that's manufactured up in this area is called gamma lipotropin. Okay? And what the research has found is that the gamma lipotropins equal in their effect to the human body that of cocaine, the amphetamines, or the pseudoamphetamines as well. For our purposes, let's call these diet pills, okay? If anyone in here has ever taken a diet pill, this is the family. So the gamma lipotropins equal the effects on the human body that of cocaine, the amphetamines, and the pseudoamphetamines. Okay. This is the next group of neurotransmitters. And I, by the way, these are groups. There's no such thing as a lonely substance up there called gamma lipotropin or unendorphin. These are families of substances, okay? Okay. The endorphins, which comes from the word the two words endomorphine, okay, endo meaning within, and morphine meaning morphine, of course, morphine from within, the endorphins equal the effects on the human body that of the opiates, which are the painkillers used, for example, and the naturally occurring opiates being morphine, opium, and codeine. And the pseudo-opiates are the synthetic opiates, everything ranging from fentanyl, dilaudid, Tylox, Percodan, Demerol, Anexia D, Hicodan, Stadol, Nubane, Darvon, Darvocet, Lomotil, etc., all the way down the line. This is the group of neurotransmitters that most is known about in these three that I'm going to be talking about. The latest studies have shown that with these endorphins, there are several uses that have been discovered. Endorphins, if you want, if you could, think of them as a basement membrane or a brain glue sort of function, apart from just a general survival mechanism to endorphins. Survival in the sense that if you've heard of the soldier that gets part of his foot blown off and is able to walk a couple of miles to a MASH station without feeling pain, you can attribute that analgesia or pain-killing effect to the body's own endorphin system. In essence, it saved that individual's life. It did not enable them to focus on the foot. What it did do was enable them to get to a place where they were able to receive some help. If you've heard of the jogger's high or runner's high, okay, this is the substances that kick in and cause that same high. If you're at all familiar with the postpartum blues or the depression that sets in after pregnancy is terminated, after the child is born, you can throughout pregnancy chart a steady rise in an endorphinemia, in other words, a blood endorphin level that steadily climbs. On childbirth, they suddenly drop off, okay? This, in essence, right here, is responsible for that depression. I'm trying to think of other examples that I can talk about the importance of the endorphins. The latest studies for this research, in this research, show that chronic relapsers, okay, alcoholics and other chemically dependent individuals who chronically are relapsing have not attained at least a 75% endorphinemia or blood endorphin level. These are highly specialized tests that can't be done in just any institution. Particularly, they're being done out in California by a doctor by the name of Dr. Forrest Tennant. In essence, what he has been able to show is for folks to enjoy and maintain an ongoing abstinence from alcohol and all other mood-altering chemicals is folks need to maintain a 75 or better blood endorphin level. Generally speaking, chronic relapsers range between 40% and 75%. Individuals in between these two figures are able to get up to 75 or better by doing certain suggestions as outlined in several successful treatment protocol. For example, such as regular exercise, cultivating a daily spiritual program, meditating. Okay, there are several healthy ways to get one's blood endorphin level up over the safe mark. Folks below the 40% mark are not able to stay in recovery. These are individuals that currently is being postulated, for example, through some mechanism or another, have damaged their endorphin-producing systems to such a point that they're not able to put out endorphins anymore. Okay, and these are the individuals that you see on Skid Row. These are the individuals that, despite the loss of husband, a loss of wife, a loss of job, a loss of respect, continue to drink and use other chemicals. The enkephalin are the third group of neurotransmitters, and the enkephalin's equal in the human system what I call the downers. Alcohol, pot, the benzodiazepine group of drugs, the Valium, Trenzine, Xanax, Xerax, Ativan, Halcyon, Clonopin, etc., chemicals. The barbiturates, everything ranging from secanol, nembutal, amitol, butazol, phenobarb, and then the miscellaneous downers, the Placidil, the Quaalude, the Miltown, the Pyraldehyde, etc. Okay? Okay, here we're back to our friend the brain. And what I want to talk about now is how a lot of this stuff was mapped out and discovered. Years and years ago on a traumatic intensive care unit where they had individuals with parts of their skulls missing secondary to major trauma, and basically due to the ready accessibility of live human brain and the willingness of these patients to take part in this type of research, metal rods were passed down. By the way, this brain here has been a brain that's been taken out and sliced lengthwise, and you're looking at it from the side, okay? These individuals allowed for metal rods to be passed down into their limbic system. Should have gotten a thicker transparency pen. And these rods were, of course, hooked up to electrical apparatus, an electrical stimulating device. And in essence, what was found was when these rods were passed into an area known today to be responsible for the production of gamma lipotropins, the patient would scream out with the sensation that you had just administered a good amount of grade A cocaine intravenously, okay? All by just stimulating a certain area of the brain and stimulating it electrically. When this rod went down into the area known today to be responsible for the production of endorphins, the same thing for the opiate high. When it went down into an area known to be responsible for the major part of production of the enkephalins, the same thing for the downers, which of course includes alcohol in that area. When this rod went down into what is now termed loosely the sex center, a male would experience an erection, ejaculate, and have an orgasm. A female, the vaginal vault would lubricate, and the female would have an orgasm. To this day, I'm sorry to report that I continue to look through several medical supply houses to have somebody sell me one of these. Nobody seems willing to want to do that. I mean, they lost interest after all this work was done. Thank you. Okay. When this rod would be placed in an area known to be responsible for the hunger zone, you could make your patient extremely hungry. Or if you went down into an area known to be responsible for the thirst, to stimulate thirst, you could make your patient thirsty. If you went into an area known to be responsible for the opposite of the hunger reflex and starved the individual for a while and then put a large tray of food in front of them while you stimulated this area, the individual would push the tray of food away. And if you went into an area known to be responsible for the opposite of the thirst reflex, while you were waving a wet rag about 2 or 3 feet away from the individual and you were stimulating that area, the person would scream out with the sensation that you were trying to drown them. Okay, so what I'm talking about is some serious survival mechanism here. What I do want to point out, let's see if this pen now works. Okay, is that a little better? Picture a gun pointing at directly at this limbic system, this survival system, this instinct center, this thing that is responsible for the survival of the organism. Picture a gun pointing there and saying in bold letters, use or die, drink alcohol or die. And this is something that only somebody that's gone through that will be able to explain to you. You see, normal people get hungry, get thirsty, get sleepy, get angry, get happy, okay? Alcoholics and chemically dependent individuals get all of that, but they have one other reflex or impulse, okay? It's to use or die. And what I do want to point out is that this use or die transcends the eating, the drinking, the drive for sex, the drive for sleep, okay? If you give an alcoholic or other chemically dependent individual the choice between their drug of choice or eating or having sex or sleeping, that individual is going to choose the chemical. Okay? Let me get into something now called withdrawal. And I briefly want to define withdrawal as emotional and physical pain that develops following discontinuation of chemicals that, if left untreated, this can result in death. And we're going to divide these periods of withdrawal. I'm being much more general during this lecture than I usually am. In essence, what I do want to bring across is that withdrawal is no longer what the medical profession thought it used to be. Okay, folks generally would think of withdrawal, would think back to the old Starsky and Hutch episodes where you'd see someone sitting in a corner shaking, you know, coming off of heroin and eating chocolate bars, okay? That's all wonderful, but that's just one type of withdrawal. I've divided this up for our purposes into two general subtypes, one being primary withdrawal, which lasts up to approximately 30 days with some exceptions. Let me go back to the heroin example that I just used. Folks generally used to think that the heroin withdrawal was the worst thing known, okay, to humankind. In essence, yeah, it's pretty horrible, and it lasts 5 to 7 days, and then it's over, and nobody dies from it, okay? Now, on the other hand, think of pot, which is, of course, if you grew up in the 60s or 70s like I did, and you think of pot along the lines that, hey, man, this is a religious experience, this is a gift from God, you know, this is naturally grown, so, I mean, it has to be okay. Okay, you're talking about pretty much a 3-month withdrawal period. Okay, that's one of the exceptions, and that's something that groups like Normal don't want to look at. Okay? Another exception to this, an exception, a big exception to that 5 or 7 withdrawal day figure for the heroin opiates, general opiates group, is for methadone, Darvon and Darvocet, and Lomotil, which can take up to about 13 weeks, is real uncomfortable, and if left untreated, can result in death. Okay? And this is just a totally new way of thinking and dealing with addictive illness than traditionally the medical profession has viewed these things or even done anything about. Generally, and I'm real sorry to say, over 90% of doctors out there, and I think I'm being generous, know very little, if nothing, about the disease of chemical dependence, the disease of alcoholism, the disease, addictive disease medicine, okay? And that's why we have formed and belong to organizations such as the American Medical Society on Alcoholism and Other Drug Dependencies, which also, by the way, is endorsed today by the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association, as well as the American Academy of Addictionology. Let me move on now to secondary withdrawal. And we call this secondary or long-term withdrawal. And we're talking about a well-defined syndrome that lasts anywhere from 3 to 36 months. And this varies from individual to individual. This depends on the substance that was being used. This depends on the amount that was being used. And this depends on the progression of that particular individual's disease. Okay? We're talking about overeating, oversleeping, undereating, undersleeping, being emotionally labile. A look will send somebody running out of the room, just completely shattering somebody into tears. Folks generally describe this, gee, doc, you know, I feel like a square peg in a round hole. Okay? Gross feelings of inadequacy, gross feelings of inappropriateness, okay? And this sort of thing does not go away when you just tell someone, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, just don't drink and go to meetings, okay? Sure, that's the bottom line. Don't drink, don't use other chemicals and go to meetings, but you need to address some of this, and you need to lend an open ear to what's going on. And generally, folks need to start talking about, you know, the fact that, hey, I feel like I'm going crazy. I feel like I'm physically going to die. Well, they, number one, need to know, yeah, it feels like you're going crazy, and it feels like you're going to physically die. But you know what? You're not going to go crazy, and you're not going to go die. You're not going to die. Okay? So it's very important that you listen to what's going on and you refer these folks to somebody that's going to tell them, hey, you're not crazy, you need to keep doing X, Y, and Z, you need to keep doing A, B, and C, but you need to basically keep working the program of recovery. This also is where some of this individualized group therapy, individualized counseling can play a very major role. We have a breakthrough on the horizon as far as replacing precursors to several of the neurotransmitters that folks can be given, okay, by mouth supplementation of neurotransmitters. These are not psychoactive or mood-altering substances, okay? We're talking about substances such as tyrosine and tryptophan and glutamine and phenylalanine and certain vitamins, okay, that are proving to be effective in the treatment of this type of symptomatology. 11.5 months. No, it's not the movie, 9.5 weeks. It's 11.5 months, okay? And what I'm talking about here is I'm bringing this up because I need for folks to really grab a hold of and understand that alcohol is just another chemical. Alcohol is just another drug. The only difference between alcohol and anything else out there is that, one, it's legal, and two, taxes are derived off of it, and three, some religious rituals do include the use of alcohol, okay? But I need for folks to understand that alcohol is just another chemical. It's just another drug. If alcohol were discovered today, I guarantee you it would be ranked up there under the Schedule II controlled substances list, where the cocaine and the Ritalin and the Seconal and the Quaalude are, okay? And the morphine and the Demerol. Alcohol would be up there. But no, on the other hand, you can now walk in, as it is, into any 7-Eleven or packaged liquor store and buy what should be a Schedule II narcotic. Okay? 11.5 months away from a pure alcoholic's last use of the chemical alcohol, away from their last drink, 11.5 months away from their last drink. If you take a little biopsy, take a little piece of muscle out of the leg, freeze it up, slice it up, put it under an electron microscope, you can still see effects of alcohol damage. 11.5 months away from the last use of alcohol, okay? And this is muscle. Think about a sensitive brain, how a brain is affected by alcohol. So anyone that says, oh, you know, alcohol, you know, there's nothing wrong with alcohol, it's not a drug, is dead wrong. And I need for you, please, to grab a hold of that. The only difference between alcohol and the other substances are that it is legal. I'm not saying, by the way, that if you don't have the disease of chemical dependence, you shouldn't drink. Of course, you know, there are people that can drink. There's no reason why they should not drink. We're talking here about a different population. We're talking about the chemically dependent individual, as well as those that misuse. Let me touch briefly on cross-addiction, cross-dependence, cross-tolerance. In essence, they all say the same thing. Picking up one substance, letting go of one substance and picking up another. Okay? Okay, let's say that someone walks into the doors of AA and says, they learn about their disease, they say that, oh, okay, I know that I'm an alcoholic, I also know that I can never, ever, ever, never touch another drop of alcohol as long as I live. And this is, by the way, when little red flags start going off in me, when I start seeing patients and they're saying this. This is where, if you recall, alcohol is. And let's say this individual winds up someplace where he or she should not be, and there just happens to be this little white powder floating around, or even worse, there happens to be a little pipe going around with some little rocks, something called crack, rock cocaine, okay? And, oh, because I know I'm in recovery and because my sponsor told me, I know that I can never, ever, ever touch alcohol again, but, you know, this stuff is harmless. You know, I see it on TV. I mean, cocaine's just psychologically addicting, and anyway, I'm just going to give it a try. I want you to understand that when that individual picks up that pipe or snorts the cocaine, two things have happened. One, he or she has just activated their chronic progressive relapsing fatal illness. They have just relapsed. They have activated this illness called chemical dependence or alcoholism. And through cross addiction, what it means is that that individual will continue to use the cocaine in an addictive manner or go back to their drug of choice, which in this case is the alcohol, and use it the way they were using it prior to walking into AA. Okay? What I also want to point out is that this here applies to Dristan, Benadryl, Contax, Sominex, Sleepies, Unisom, you name it, any over-the-counter product that is mood-altering, that is psychoactive, can be lumped under one of these categories, okay? And this is why practically with our patients, when we prescribe certain medications, even over-the-counter medications, because certain individuals are going to need certain substances in their recovery. We need to face that. The disease has to be, the treatment has to be individualized, okay? We will even treat over-the-counter medications as a prescribed substance. I'll have the pharmacist label a bottle of Coricidin, which is what we approve for in our program for our patients' use, okay? Because these are psychoactive substances. So what I need for you to understand is that any use of any over-the-counter medication as well as any of the legal or illegal drugs are going to activate this disease process. The reason that this works is that there's a substance up here at the top, ACTH, adrenocorticotropic hormone, and what this does in essence, it stimulates the body's own production of hydrocortisone. Okay, the reason that this cross-addiction stuff really, really works is that gamma-lipotropin has been found to chemically come off of the ACTH molecule, the endorphins to come off of the gamma-lipotropins, and the enkephalins to come off of the endorphin molecule. So there's no getting away from this ladder, if you wish to call it that, a ladder. I do want to take this time to briefly mention that this is a disease of feelings, okay, out of which develop the five major compulsive disorders. Understand we're talking about alcoholism or just chemical dependence in general. Out of which develop the five major compulsive disorders. And I need for folks to pay real close attention to this because folks run into trouble. These, in essence, out in the community can be termed emotional relapses, okay, if you would. Of course, the addiction to alcohol and other drugs, the addiction to food, the addiction to work, the addiction to sex/relationships, and the addiction to gambling or compulsive spending, the addiction to power have been lumped together down under the fifth. I've expanded a little on these. Let me just briefly, for our purposes, just talk about the work addiction because I think it does bear out how this can involve someone in an active relapse dynamic where they wind back up at the chemical use. If Joe or Mary walk into the doors of AA or they go to treatment and they find out, yeah, okay, I know I can never ever touch alcohol or any other substance for that matter for the rest of my life on a one day at a time frame, okay, but now I really want to get back out there and I want to show society what a good individual I am. I want my family to love me and depend on me and trust me. So I'm just going to go ahead and really give it all I got at work, okay? In essence, what is this individual doing? They're spending about 10, 12, 14 hours at work, okay, where they're being told, gee, you know, it's great to have you back. You're such a wonderful employee. You really are good at what it is that you do. And they're getting stroked. All these wonderful strokes that folks in early recovery just thrive on. Okay, and there's nothing wrong with that in moderation. But then what also is going on? Of course, apart from extra bucks that are being earned, what the other thing that is going on is that this individual isn't going home and isn't dealing with the wife or the husband or the sick kids. And in essence, work is acting like a drug, okay? It becomes a drug to someone in recovery. I don't have to deal with the family. It makes me feel wonderful because they tell me that I'm such a good employee, I'm on top of the world, so in essence, it is a drug, okay? The same thing, you can go down this list and do that with all these others, except we don't have the time. Okay, let me talk briefly. And I'm gonna credit Dr. David Ohms for this, as well as certain other individuals that I neglected to mention in the beginning, Dr. Douglas Talbot, Dr. Douglas Jusen, Dr. David Smith. This particular transparency refers to a mechanism that was proposed by Dr. David Ohms. And what I want to talk about now is the human body and what it does with alcohol. Okay, we put alcohol into the body, and it is then metabolized to something called acetaldehyde, okay, which then is metabolized down to carbon dioxide and water. And if this is all that happened, this would be wonderful. Everyone would be able to drink ad infinitum, and it would be great, right? But what happens actually is that a very small percentage of the acetaldehyde, while it's running around in the brain of the alcoholic, links up to a neurotransmitter called dopamine, okay? And everyone has dopamine. No, it's not the stuff that makes you dopey. It's just a neurotransmitter that you need in order to be alive, okay? So a very small percentage of the acetaldehyde links up to dopamine while it's up in the brain of the alcoholic, forming a substance called tetrahydropapaviroline, which is one of the THIQs, in other words, the tetrahydroisoquinolines, okay? And I know everyone here knows what that is, but I'll just explain. This here are metabolites of the opiates. In plain English, this is a metabolite of morphine. This is a metabolite of heroin, okay? This is what the alcoholic is forming up in the brain by drinking some alcohol. Okay? What happens is these little substances, which act like keys. Okay, no, that can't be seen too well. This sits down in the lock. This here is the THP, the tetrahydropapaviroline, that was formed with the acetaldehyde and the dopamine. And this is the lock. This is a normal receptor site in the brain that generally receives substances called enkephalins that we mentioned briefly. It's where alcohol is lumped under. Okay? And in essence, this takes the place of the enkephalin. What there are two things that go on here. One, it takes the place of the enkephalin, and two, it shuts down the production of the enkephalin because the feedback mechanism to the brain says, whoop, that's enough, we don't need any more enkephalin. So when the alcoholic puts the glass down, where normally some enkephalin would come flooding in there, there is none. So the alcoholic's going to pick up the glass again because this is part of that 75 to better percent of endorphinemia that I talked about earlier that is necessary in order to maintain a sense of well-being or sobriety, okay? How this was discovered was years ago, this doctor out in Texas was doing research on brain cancer and for her work needed fresh human brain. And the best way to get a hold of some fresh human brain, dead brain, is to scan the skid row areas and pick up on street people, homeless people, alcoholic, addicted individuals that die. You pick them up, and this was years ago, okay? And when they were brought to her and she did the preparation of the tissues and the work that she had to do, she promptly discovered that all of these skid row alcoholics had the substance THP, or other tetrahydroisoquinolines in their brains, okay? And these individuals were not heroin addicts. They were not Dilaudid addicts. They were straight alcoholics. So this is what started this process up. This is what caught the researcher's eye. This study was further taken down the road by a group of researchers with lab rats that have been bred to not touch alcohol even if their life depended on it, okay? So with these lab rats, what they did with the lab rats were put them in cages without without water and without food, just with alcohol. These rats chose to die, okay? All of the rats died. With the same type of rat was then used for a small amount of THP, or tetrahydropapaviroline, was injected into the brain of the rat, which then was placed back into the same laboratory situation. No food, no water, just alcohol. Now, this same strain of rat that would not touch alcohol before, even if its life depended on it, now could not drink enough alcohol, would kill itself drinking the alcohol. Okay? This is to give you an idea of the power of the THIP. They ran across the THIQs back in World War II when they were trying to perfect painkillers for the battlefield in the World War II eras. They found THP and other THIQs and promptly shelved them because they found that these substances were 150 times more addicting than heroin. Okay? That pretty much wraps up what it is that I have to offer, and I thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to answering your questions within the next hour during the question box. Thank you very much. While that question is still fresh, I blocked while I was giving my lecture when we came to the section on endorphins. That the latest research has shown that nicotine products directly stimulate the body's own endorphin system, as borne out in studies made of folks that are placed in a program deprived of their nicotine products, and an opiate withdrawal-like syndrome sets in. In other words, folks going through nicotine withdrawal basically can't be differentiated all that much from somebody going through opiate withdrawal. What we are now doing in Atlanta, apart from offering folks Nicorette gum to help ease this process, is offering folks, not in the public sector, but in the private treatment facilities, the drug Catapress, which some of you may be familiar with the fact that this is a drug used for the treatment of high blood pressure. It is not FDA or Food and Drug Administration approved for the treatment of opiate withdrawal. We are doing that. The FDA also has not approved the use of Catapress in the treatment of nicotine withdrawal, but we have begun to do this, as I said, in the private sector. And it is just as effective in treating nicotine withdrawal as it is in treating, for example, heroin withdrawal. So I do want to point out that that is one of the main reasons that someone's use of nicotine products, meaning cigarette, pipe, cigar, smokeless tobacco, increases when one enters recovery, because the body desperately searches out for a way to fill in the body's need for the enkephalin endorphin levels to be raised. I also will point out that we do have a movement in treatment now where we are encouraging every alcoholic and addicted individual to not continue to smoke through the first, second, third, through seventh year. I mean, out in the recovering community, you hear, oh, it's okay, continue to smoke, you're sober today. Okay, what people aren't realizing is they're putting off a hellacious bottom for about 20 years when the emphysema is going to set in, when the diagnosis of lung cancer is going to rear up, when bladder cancer, laryngeal cancer, voice box cancer. There's no need to put off somebody, a chemically dependent individual's bottom 20, 30, 40 years. You need to tackle that addiction while someone's walking into the treatment program or AA or NA the moment they walk in. I really encourage you to not enable the smoker in your home. If you're a smoker yourself, please consider doing something about your own smoking. Do it for yourself. Do it for those that love you.